Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Stephen. Great to be here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. So I'm going to ask you in a minute to just tell us what you've been doing for the last few years, just so we can, and then I'll go into questions just so we could get an update on what you've been doing. But I guess for the audience, and just to be clear of the significance of this panel, according to rough statistics that I just find quickly on Google, it looks like 50% of the country, I'm not sure if it's adults or the country, but 50%, let's say, of adults have diabetes or prediabetes. And then what a lot of people are not aware of is that somehow chronic kidney disease, which is not talked about regularly, somehow I believe that I've seen numbers as high as 15%, which sounds astonishingly high for something that is not talked about all the time. And I'm also under the impression, and we'll get clarification on this, that diabetes leads to chronic kidney disease in many cases. So that's why this panel is of great significance, because this is something we would like to prevent, not react to. So if you could each give an opening minute about what you've been doing for the last 10 years, Cyrus, Robbie, and then Dr. Hashmi.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Stephen. It's great to be here again. I appreciate you putting this conference on, and you do such a great job of trying to educate the masses. So it's really a job well done.
Thank you.
So I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes back in the year 2002. So since that time, it's given me a great opportunity to try and understand how I can manage the condition to the best of my ability. And in the process of doing that, I learned that a plant-based diet is a tremendous tool that I can use to not only control my blood glucose, but also significantly improve my overall health. So I went back to graduate school in the year 2007 for 5 years to learn to get a PhD in understanding the ins and outs of nutritional biochemistry. And then I went on to co-create Mastering Diabetes to really educate the masses about what it is that causes blood glucose dysregulation. The name of the game is insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is the precursor to prediabetes and type 2 diabetes. And just like you said, Stephen, prediabetes and type 2 diabetes doesn't always lead to chronic kidney disease, but it can significantly increase the risk for the development of chronic kidney disease, as Dr. Sean can, you know, elaborate on. And so it's all sort of one, you know, interconnected constellation of problems. So to answer your question, what have I been up to? Over the past 6 months, I actually left Mastering Diabetes. So I'm no longer with the company. I've created a new company. The new company is called Evolution Health. And I have been growing that company to really, you know, try and help people understand how to not only get rid of the insulin resistance pathology, but also focus on improving their heart health and significantly reducing inflammation to reduce their overall chronic disease burden. So I appreciate you being, you know, given the opportunity to be here today, and we can have some fun.
Thank you. Robbie?
Yeah, so I have been living with type 1 diabetes for over 25 years now. I was diagnosed January 26th of 2000. And over the course of time, you know, just living with a chronic condition like that, I learned a lot. And, you know, initially being put through the conventional medical system, you know, my parents, they wanted to make sure I had the best medical care possible. So they made sure, my brother is also living with type 1 diabetes, and they would take us to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And at that time, so I was 12 years old, nobody said anything about changing my lifestyle to prevent complications and really just take care of myself. They literally just said, wow, we just want you to feel normal. We want you to be like your friends. You can eat whatever you want. Just make sure to take the insulin. And in hindsight, that's a really, it's a missed opportunity, because type 1 diabetes is a fascinating condition where we get this immediate feedback data on like how our lifestyle choices are impacting the units of insulin that we have to inject, which is really fascinating. You know, I know Dr. Furman has actually been quoted in saying how like your fasting insulin level is a greater indicator of what's going to happen to your cardiovascular risk than even your cholesterol number. Like fasting insulin and knowing how much insulin your body needs is so important. So as type ones, you know, we have to inject insulin. So we can see meal by meal what happens to how our lifestyle choices impact our insulin use and our blood glucose levels. And now we have these CGMs, and I've been wearing a CGM now for, it's got to be over a decade at this point. And the CGM has taught me so much about how my lifestyle choices impact my blood glucose control. So I've been on this journey of following a low-fat, plant-based whole food diet since 2006. And like Cyrus said, in 2017, co-created Mastering Diabetes together. We wrote the book, Mastering Diabetes, and that's impacted a lot of people. And so, yeah, what am I working on these days? Just continuing to help people adopt the Mastering Diabetes method and implement that in their life and have the support and guidance from our team to do that. So that's what I've been focused on. I'm an athlete. I train for Ironmans and feel really good about how the Mastering Diabetes method, when applied, like I'm not some, you know, random, it's not like I'm some exceptional example or something. I literally just follow the method, and that's how I have an A1C of 5.5%, time in range of 91% on my CGM. And I don't have to take any other medications, no complications so far with 25 years living with type 1. And I'm gonna keep it that way and just really help people follow this method. So that's what I've been working on.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you know, let me start by saying, how cool is it to get to share this panel with Cyrus and Robbie? So awesome to see you guys again. And
you too.
It's been a long time since we connected. So this is great to see you guys. For my last 10 years, you know, my base has always been kidneys, and I started in kidneys, gosh, now for two decades or so and change. But then I got involved in the obesity aspect. So I got boarded in obesity medicine, and I was involved with the lifestyle arm forever. So now I actually, my day job is split 50-50 between running the lifestyle and obesity arm, where we tackle all sorts of issues, including diabetes, all of the latest and greatest craze around the new weight loss drugs, the GLP-1s, the GLPs, GIPs, the upcoming triple agonist, and all sorts of things. So I call them vitamin O and vitamin T. And if I don't hear one more word about it, I would be a happy person. And then in terms of kidneys, you know, what's fascinating, and I think I heard a comment about the incidence is underrepresented because kidney disease has no symptoms. And as a result of it, worldwide, the majority of patients who have kidney disease don't even know they have it. So this 10% number that folks like myself throw around, it's 9.8 to be exact, but that 10% number is actually very much underestimated simply because of the fact that if you have heart disease, you will feel it right away. You got shortness of breath, you got sometimes chest pain, you'll lead to swelling. But with kidney disease, you can lose as much as 80% of your kidney function and still be walking around and have no symptoms. And as a result of that, education around that matters. And, you know, sometimes there was this saying I heard the other day, and it stuck with me, was when average people walk around, they're worried about everything in their life. They're worried about social media. They're worried about what they're going to wear, the latest haircut that Cyrus and I are going to go get. All of those things are on top of their mind. But when they get a disease, every single worry goes away because the only worry they have is, how do I fix my disease? And I know Cyrus agrees with me and Robbie agrees with me on this, is our goal has always been that we don't want you to get to that point where all of a sudden everything else in life disappears and all you're focused on is, how do I get through one more day? How do I get to be around this planet, this life, this thing that I've tried to build around me to enjoy my kids' moments one more day so that I can have something? You know, purpose is what everything matters. It's all about purpose in life. But in order for us to achieve that purpose, you also got to make sure you're well enough to be able to get there. It's the same airplane analogy we tell everybody. If God forbid your airplane's going down, and the pilot, the staff on the airplane, they tell you, put the mask on yourself first before you even put it on your child. And that matters.
Okay, thank you. Just to start, in terms of your recommendations you're going to make, do you have different recommendations for people with type 1 diabetes, type 1.5 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, for chronic kidney disease? Are we talking about the same program for everyone, or does it change in terms of what foods to eat depending on what we're whether it's 1, 1.5, 2, or kidney disease?
If you don't mind, I can throw my weight in on this one. When we were developing the Mastering Diabetes method, we recognized early on in the game that there's so many different flavors of diabetes. You got type 1, type 1.5, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes. And it can be pretty confusing to try and understand what they are, what causes them, and what can you do to try and, you know, get out of jail. And when I was doing my graduate degree back from, you know, UC Berkeley for 5 years, I was asking myself the same question, because I'm living with type 1 diabetes, which only affects 8% of the population, or 8% of the diabetes population. And then there's another, you know, 92% of the diabetes population that's living with pre-diabetes and type 2. So what I was looking for was a simplified way of trying to unite the entire world of diabetes. And what we ended up coming up with is that the treatment protocol that you can employ to reverse the pathology that creates pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes is the same protocol that you can implement to get exceptional control of type 1 and 1.5. So let's do a quick thought experiment here. Let's not use the word diabetes at all. Let's take diabetes out of our vocabulary. We're not talking about type 1. We're not talking about type 1.5. We're not talking about pre-diabetes or type 2 or gestational. We're just talking about blood glucose dysregulation. And if we talk about blood glucose dysregulation, trying to understand what causes that, okay, there's multiple answers to that. But in the what can influence blood glucose and cause it to do erratic things is unified amongst all human beings, whether you're 2 years old and normal weight or whether you're 75 years old and overweight, okay? And one of the things that has come true in the research is that excessive consumption of dietary fat can suppress carbohydrate metabolism. In other words, when you eat a significant quantity of fat, predominantly saturated fat, it causes your blood glucose to do strange things. And so this simplified, unified strategy that seems to work across all forms of diabetes, all forms of blood glucose dysregulation, is to consume a diet that isn't devoid of fat, because that's not even possible, but to try and minimize your fat intake to approximately 30 grams per day. And if you can get it to that level, and you can simultaneously increase the total amount of food that you're eating that comes from the plant-based world, that comes from fiber-rich fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains, what you are likely to find is exactly what thousands of people have already found in who have reversed pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes and controlled type 1 with precision, which is that it works for all forms of blood glucose dysregulation. So if the name of the game is to try and flatline blood glucose and try and keep it as controllable as possible, the two tricks to getting there are, number one, suppress total fat intake to approximately 30 grams per day. And simultaneously, number two, increase the total amount of plant material that goes into your mouth. And if you can successfully do that day in and day out for months to years at a time, you're likely to find that the, you know, your ability to control your blood glucose is significantly improved.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's absolutely true. Like, you know, we wrote the book Mastering Diabetes, that we put the whole system, the subtitle, the revolutionary method to reverse insulin resistance permanently in type 1, type 1.5, type 2, pre-diabetes, and gestational diabetes. Like, it's one system that will apply to all forms of diabetes. And we've unified things. So we're focused on one thing. It's what lifestyle choices can you make to make insulin work more efficiently? It doesn't matter if you are injecting insulin because you're living with type 1 and you're not producing any. It doesn't matter if you have to inject just a little bit more because you're living with type 1.5 and you're only producing a little bit. It doesn't matter if you're living with insulin-dependent type 2 and you need to inject a little extra insulin because your pancreas is burned out. Or when you're initially pre-diabetes type 2, you might be injecting insulin just because you're so insulin resistant. You might be able to completely get off that insulin. So it doesn't matter. It's the same approach, which is, what are we going to do to make insulin work more efficiently? And it's a beautiful system, and it absolutely works.
And then adding on to that, when we start to talk about kidney disease, the three biggest causes of kidney disease that account for more than two-thirds of the cases is diabetes, is high blood pressure, and its weight. And it turns out that if you want to tackle all three, the solution to all three is exactly the same thing. So there's this thing where nowadays, because of sort of all of the social media and the TikTok and Instagram and all this, everyone is looking for a two-second fix. And the problem with looking for a two-second fix is the two-second fix gives you a two-second solution and then it's gone. These things that all of us talk about repeatedly, like a broken record, is because these things work. They're not exciting. I think they're not exciting. I think they're not sort of quote unquote sexy or brand new or so forth that we can say that, oh my God, I got the most secretive treatment whatsoever. But it turns out that if you start to do these basics, this is the same stuff that prevents cancers. It prevents dementia. It lowers the risk of high blood pressure, lowers high blood pressure if you already have it, lowers your kidney disease. And when you start to think about the alternatives, there's lots of ways to lose weight. There really is. You can go ahead and starve yourself and you lose weight. I can talk about over 2,200 different diets out there. Each one of them can cause weight loss. But if you're only going after weight loss, then that's great. You're going to be the best looking person in the grave. Our job is, while you're still around, we want you to be the best looking person that you can possibly be. And once again, the goal of life is not to accumulate things, not to know who lived to be the longest, but who lived well. And being well and having better health span has far greater value, especially as you start to get older, than how long you're going to live. How long you're going to live if you spend 20 years of your life bedridden or in a hospital, or you can't think and not know where you're at. Those are the kind of things that we should start to focus on.
Thank you. So if someone has listened to you or read your books, and I read Mastering Diabetes, and they say, okay, I'm going to listen to exactly what you say. I am going to exercise. I'm going to stretch. I'm going to do aerobics. I'm going to do weightlifting. And I'm going to eat a whole food plant-based diet. I'm going to have no animal products. I'm not going to add any oil. And I'm going to have very minimal amounts of seeds, nuts, avocados, or olives. And I'll have no coconuts either. So now they've eating a whole food plant-based diet, they're virtually eliminating the fat, or in this case, let's assume they get rid of the seeds, nuts, avocados. So they're just eating fruits, vegetables, beans, and grains. And assume they do intermittent fasting where they eat at 7 o'clock and don't eat the next day till 11. The question is, of the last 1,000 people you saw who did this, how many had a healthy fasting blood sugar at 80 or 85? And how many were at 90, and how many were at 95, how many were at 100, and how many couldn't get it below 100? Even though they did what you said, they were still stuck between 100 and 110, and how many were over 110? Like in the real world with real people, did this absolutely work? Or you're saying, well, in 15% of the people, they still hit 130 fasting blood glucose. So what were the actual real results of people who followed this with their fasting blood sugar in the morning?
Oh, that sounds like a terrible regimen. Who would do anything the way that you just described? That's horrible. Just kidding. That was a joke. Okay. Stephen, here's the truth from my perspective. I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know the answer to the question. In order to get the answer to your question, what we'd have to do is a randomized control trial, or, you know, basically an observational study, where we take 1,000 people that have gone through this process and we basically monitor them over the course of, you know, in my opinion, somewhere with like 6 to 9 months, and basically try and determine exactly what you said. What is your fasting blood glucose? Where does it fall? And most importantly, what type of change did you see before and after the intervention? Okay. So because I don't have that study in front of me, because we haven't had an opportunity to conduct that study, I'm gonna hazard a guess here. Okay. And the guess that I would say is that the way that I like to think about it, we got to take a couple of things into account. Number one, the duration of time that somebody follows this regimen. Okay. So if somebody were to follow the regimen that you described and they were to do it for somewhere between realistically 9 months and 12 months, that's the amount of time that I would suggest doing it before you can really draw any significant conclusions. Because again, just like Dr. Sean said, We're trying to turn this into something that you can do for a lifetime. We want this to be something that you can do for over the course of many months to years, not just something that you can do today and then something that, you know, you can, you know, check off of your to-do list. All right. So if we're going to look at it from a 9 to 12 month perspective, that gives you enough time. It gives you enough compounded effects over the course of many months to years. It gives you enough at bats for you to basically say, okay, is this working or is this not working? Okay. So if we were to look over that period of time, and if you were to look at somebody who was truly compliant following that methodology, my theory or my feeling is that you could probably get something like close to 70 to 80% of all people who will achieve a fasting blood glucose underneath 100. Okay. Less than 100. Okay. So it depends on where your fasting blood glucose started. If your blood glucose started at a 250, that's a different scenario than if your blood glucose started out at 120. But again, the effect of time is sort of it equalizes many things. And over the course of 9 to 12 months, we've seen people make dramatic changes with a fasting blood glucose that comes down by 100 or more points, no questions asked. Okay. Now, 70 to 80% of people will get a blood glucose that, you know, fasting blood glucose that drops below 100. 70 to 80% of all people are going to see their A1C drop, you know, less than 6.0, which is fantastic, which is, you know, close to approaching the non-diabetic range. But then there's a small element of the population, you know, call it somewhere between, you know, 15 to 20% of the population who has experienced significant damage to their pancreas. And these people end up having what's called a low C-peptide value. A C-peptide basically is a marker of insulin production. And you can, it's an easy blood test. You can just go and you can have a fasting C-peptide measured. And it basically tells you how much insulin secretory capacity you have. For people that have a very low C-peptide value, that's generally speaking less than 1 nanogram per milliliter, what they find is that no matter what they do, no matter how much exercise they perform, no matter how much intermittent fasting they do, no matter how low fat their diet, no matter how much fiber-rich foods, their fasting blood glucose still does not come beneath 100. Okay, so those are the people who are going to find this to be challenging, and they're going to throw their hands up in the air and say, guys, I'm doing everything. This doesn't work. Okay, the answer is it does work. It's just that a low C-peptide value means that your pancreas has experienced a sufficient amount of damage over the course of time, and the beta cells aren't capable of secreting a sufficient amount of insulin. And as a result of that, those individuals are likely to need small amounts of insulin in order to control their blood glucose fully. Okay, so I'll stop there, but that's my that's what we've seen from the research, and that's what I would predict would happen if we were to take 1,000 people and do an observational study with them.
Just quickly, you said they would need insulin if their blood sugar, fasting blood sugar, is 110. Are you saying they would need insulin, or are you just saying?
Well, no, so that's a good question. So not necessarily in that scenario. What we have to take into account is not what's your fasting blood glucose, but what's happening over the course of a day. Okay. A lot of times people who don't manufacture a significant amount of insulin will find that even if their fasting blood glucose is 110 in the morning, okay, that's still pretty close to 100. So we're doing a good job. But when they eat food, because their pancreas is not manufacturing a sufficient amount of insulin at the time that they're eating food, their blood glucose could climb all the way north of 220, 240, 250. And then it could stay there for some period of time before it comes back down. If that is the scenario that you're in, then yes, we might want to talk about, you know, using insulin to try and help control your blood glucose in addition to your lifestyle. But if you're another type of person with a fasting blood glucose of 110, you eat some food and your blood glucose climbs to 130 and then it comes back down within 2 hours, then we're not in the same situation. That type of individual is likely to probably not need insulin, but definitely wants to monitor over the course of time and hopefully try and avoid that at all costs. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've 100% I agree with everything Cyrus just said there. And I would just add that, you know, from our experience, what will happen, I can say with complete confidence, in like 99.99% of the cases, what you will see is that their insulin sensitivity improved, right? If you're looking at just did their number get below 100, okay, like there's a lot of nuance, just like Cyrus talked about there. But in every case, as long as you figure out, like you do the C-peptide, you figure out how much insulin they are using, if they need insulin, like you will objectively be able to observe that by following these principles, insulin worked more efficiently across the board, as long as you know what's going on in their body about their insulin production. So if that was a type one of those 1,000 people that came across our table, like type one, I have never seen a single case were like a type one, did everything you just said they were doing, and they didn't eat more total carbohydrate and need less insulin. Like, period, end of story. Like, it just, there's no exception. And so the same thing would happen for people living with prediabetes and type 2 diabetes. It's just the only nuance comes along with how much damage has been done to the beta cells. And do you need to use exogenous insulin to compensate for that? So if somebody had a C-peptide of like 3, 4, something like that, then yeah, they're going to fit in that category of 100% success. Like, no question.
Thank you. Dr. Hashmi, anything you want to add to that?
No, nothing really to add. I think Cyrus and Robbie covered it really well.
Okay. So then, Dr. Hashmi, regarding kidney disease, where do you stand on the use of fat in the diet? And let's assume we're talking about healthy fat now. We're talking about avocados, nuts, seeds, olives. And also, after you talk about fat, then move on to salt. In other words, we're having a conference. We have 80 speakers. They're all very smart, all credentialed. And lots of speakers are fat positive. Not animal product, but they're saying absolutely, you know, nuts and seeds are part of it. They differ on how much we should have. They're pro avocado, they're pro olives. And some of them, half of them, it seems, are pro salt. They're saying that table salt is not good, but if you can get salt from a mineral bed where it has the 92 minerals still intact, that actually is beneficial. So if you're someone watching this conference, you are not sure where we stand on fats, and you're not sure where we stand on salt. And from a kidney point of view, where do you stand on this?
Well, when it comes to kidneys, you know, this is where I think if you put 10 experts in a room and you had to change a light bulb, the light bulb would end up never getting changed. And that's the problem with nowadays is when we ask these kind of questions, we're trying to show how one person is smarter than the other. And that just depends on how popular they are and how much social media and what they've done. So I don't believe in any of those things. What I can tell you is the data around kidney disease is very, very simple. What the data shows is that the more salt you add to your diet, the more your blood vessels do end up getting stiff. What the data clearly shows is that the American diet is full of a ton of sodium already present. It doesn't matter what type of salt you end up using it. If you have a combination of lots of processed foods, very rich in cholesterol, very rich in salt, you're going to end up in a situation where you're going to have higher inflammation. I can't sort of go against that because of the fact that we have excellent studies. And if, once again, I am not the expert, don't think of me as the expert, but this is why I kind of laugh when people talk about experts, because there aren't any experts. There really aren't. People say the same line over and over again, and then other people start to believe it. But we have this thing where we have the ability to critically analyze studies. You know, I can take $500 right now and go publish a study. All I need is $500. And I can publish a study right now to basically say the earth is flat. And if I can convince enough people, they will believe it. So starting on the issue of sodium is, it's not that it's just the salt. This is why whenever we talk about it's just the fat, it's just the salt, it really depends on the context in which you're saying. So for example, there was a study done in the 70s. They had two groups of miners. They both mined in the same place. They both came home. They drank, they smoked, they did every bad thing that you can imagine. One group was dying, the other group wasn't dying. And they asked the question, well, why the heck does this make any sense? Why is one group dying and the other not? Turns out one group was smoking, drinking, doing everything together and having that social connection. The other one went alone and did everything. So some of the stuff that we don't talk about enough is very simple. We don't talk about the fact that sleep is such a critical part of our overall health. You sleep less, you die sooner. There is no other way around it. There's the very rare 1% of people who can actually physically sleep less and not have damage. Us mere mortals, if you're sleeping less than 7 hours, you're going to get damage. Movement, it's very simple. There is no pill that can make up for exercise, and exercise can't make up for a bad diet. This whole concept of social connection or gratitude, it matters so much. In fact, the problem with the question that you asked me is specifically that what we try to do is we try to create these restrictive thoughts and that can't do this, must do that. The problem is for people who are absolutely confused, they're scared, they might have come from all sorts of things. I know that Tina in the chat talked about this, but in my obesity clinic, the majority of my patients who are suffering from obesity, it's not like they don't know they should put the pizza down. They don't know they should put the donut down. They already know that. They've been told a million times that they need to exercise. They need to stop eating this stuff, but they can't, not won't. They can't do it. And it's because we create this stuff that makes it so hard that when you finally get around to eating, should I eat the fat? Shouldn't I eat the fat? So this is where what we talk about is principles. We say, look, we didn't start out as hunters and gatherers. We started out as gatherers, and then we lived closer to the oceans to basically hunt fish who couldn't beat us up. That's how you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, is where we started. We know that the data supports the idea that the more you're able to eat whole foods in your diet, the more you got all the colors of the rainbow, the healthier you're going to be. Beyond that, it starts to become in a place where every time we start to go there, we actually turn off people, then turn on people. One of the beauties of this concept of lifestyle is supposed to be that we embrace life and we embrace style. And the concept here is we're welcoming. We want to bring people in. For all the experts out there who argue one way or the other, more power to you. But at the end of the day, that patient who's sitting at home alone, scared, doesn't know who to turn to or talk to, I want him or her to know that they can come to me with open arms and we can talk about where they're at and we can meet them where they're at and then bring them into this world. This world is already becoming so complicated. You know, when I started in this field, plant-based burgers were just coming out. And it was like blasphemous if, God forbid, you ended up saying that plant-based burgers are bad for you. It was like you just committed the worst crime in the world. And yet, now the data is very clear that, yes, they're really bad for you. And this is why it becomes so hard, is what we want to focus on is not what's all that bad. How do we get people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables? That's the question we should be asking. How do we get kids to like fresh fruits and vegetables when every single cereal box is specifically designed to trigger an emotion? We can argue for salt all day long, but tell me how many lives you're going to save by talking about the fact that you need Himalayan salt or regular salt versus the person who's dying of a heart attack, and we have the ability to be able to touch and save tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of lives, not just in the United States. We're talking across the world. And so my practice is very simple. It's focused on how do I take the common denominator that's in all the diets. I've never heard a diet that said, go eat more hot dogs or go eat more pizza. Every diet tries to steer clear. What I try to do is try to make the most fundamental things more exciting, more at your level, more affordable, more accessible, and ways that you and your kids will actually want to take it in.
Thank you. Robbie and Cyrus, so where do you stand on salt? And being more specific, what is the actual amount of fat from healthy sources that you do want in the diet? I had heard you say 15% of total calories. Is that ideal, or is that just what your guidelines? Would you rather we had no fat? So what amount of salt, and thoughts on that? What percentage of fat? Those two things, if you could let us know.
Great. Yeah. So I'm gonna give Dr. Sean a giant shout out right here, because I think what he just verbalized is something that I've been sort of like thinking for a long time in my head. And also, you know, he's very eloquent in his conversation here. When it comes to nitpicking individual components of a diet, we can kind of get down a rabbit hole very easily by saying this much salt is okay, and you have to have this many milligrams of vitamin C, and it's necessary to have this many grams of protein and this many grams of carbohydrate and fat and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's validity to each one of these recommendations. And there's also,
you know, there's also controversy that can arise from giving any type of any type of recommendation. So what I can speak to is that in the world of people living with blood glucose dysregulation, okay, if I had to take two people, you know, let me separate people into two separate groups. I got people who are living with blood glucose dysregulation as group number one, and then everyone else in group number two. And I know it's a ridiculous generalization, but I'm just going to create those two groups just, you know, for the sake of this argument, okay? When you're living with some form of blood glucose dysregulation, it's necessary to be just a little bit more stringent on the total fat intake that goes into your mouth. And this is total fat intake. And rather than nitpicking the difference between unsaturated fat and saturated fat. So what I have come to learn over the course of many years of research, about 20 years of personal experimentation, working with a lot of people, and then also reading the research, is that there seems to be a somewhat magical threshold bordering around the number 30 grams per day. Okay. So whether you want to think of it as 15% of total calories or total grams per day, I think it's just easier to think about it in terms of number of grams per day. So if you use a diet logging app, you can basically pick one up and you can basically write down everything that you're eating on a daily basis. And for people who have a blood glucose dysregulation, if you can control your total fat intake to being approximately 30 grams per day or so, you know, with a little bit of wiggle room around that, and you can maintain that consistently over the course of time. And again, secondarily, just like Dr. Hashmi was saying, you know, eat a predominantly plant-rich diet as much as possible, okay? Try and maximize the total amount of, you know, fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains on a daily basis. If you can accomplish that, blood glucose will become significantly easier to control. Now, okay, fine, blood glucose sounds like a plan, but when your blood glucose becomes easier to control, it lowers your risk for prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, or helps you reverse the pathology that created those two conditions in the first place. Now, that's just a gateway. Okay. When your blood glucose becomes more controllable, it lowers the amount of inflammation inside of your liver. It lowers the amount of inflammation inside of your blood vessels. It lowers the amount of inflammation inside of your muscle tissue. It also lowers the amount of inflammation inside of your kidney. And then that in turn can lower your risk for the development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. That in turn can lower your risk for the development of chronic kidney disease. That in turn can lower your risk for the development of Alzheimer's disease 20, 30, 40 years into the future. That unto itself can then set the stage for a reduction in the risk for heart disease, for high cholesterol, for high blood pressure, and coronary artery disease and beyond. So my recommendation here is somewhere around 30 grams is what I have found to be over the course of time about the sort of the magic threshold. Now, when it comes to salt, I don't personally have any specific recommendations on salt intake. I think salt is, again, just like Dr. Hashmi said, it's missing the forest for the trees. Okay. So I'm gonna take the fifth on that recommendation. And I'm gonna say there's no necessity to have to add salt to your diet. If you choose to add salt to your diet, that is your choice. And you know, the recommendations are to try and get somewhere around 1,000 milligrams on a daily basis of extraneous extra salt. Again, I don't have any research to prove whether or not that's a wise decision in the long term. So I'm going to take the fifth on that one. But, I've never been convinced that it is necessary to have to add salt into your diet in order to maintain optimal health over the course of time.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with, I would agree with everything that's been said here. And I would just add that, what we focus on at Mastering Diabetes is personalized coaching, right? So each individual is different and you have to acknowledge that. And, something Dr. Sean was sharing with us early, like sometimes in medicine, like you're trying to pick like least of the two harms, right? You're trying to like just evaluate what's the best case forward. What's the best way to move forward here. And it's different for each individual. And that has to be important. I know, it's just, you have to acknowledge that. It's like, where are you starting and where are you going? Like, what are your goals? And so it's not easy to just have like black and white lines. With that said, I do know that some people will appreciate some guidelines. It makes it it's easier or simple. Okay, well, this is the North Star. This is the guideline. So I'm going to shoot towards working towards that and having a coach help guide somebody towards doing that. So, I agree with everything that's been said here. And, 15% is a good maximum to shoot for if you have blood glucose challenges. That's the bottom line. And you'll see a lot of people, you know, if you're not predisposed to that, you don't have that problem right now, then yeah, maybe bumping it up to 20, 25, not such a big deal, right? But that's where the whole personalized approach comes in. Like, where are you starting? What challenges do you have? Like, I think people's genetic history matters here, right? What other medical conditions do they have? Like, has your gallbladder been removed? Like, there's just so many things to consider in all these recommendations. I think it's just, it's gotta be personalized. You know, I don't know what Dr. Sean and Cyrus would say here, but like, you know, the 1500 milligram guideline from the American Heart Association seems like a pretty solid one. So if you're looking for a number to be like, okay, I'm just not gonna exceed that much sodium, could be a good guideline, but certainly just, you know, working with a doctor you trust is the best way forward for your optimal health outcomes.
Thank you.
And that's a great point, Robbie. And just to add a couple comments to that. First is, you know, I still hear this a lot where they say, you know, doctors nowadays in training don't get any nutrition education. You know, that's changed. So for all the audience listening today, there are so many of our lifestyle medicine doctors that are now trained and going back into medical schools. There are so many medical schools across the country that are now starting to educate, not just on the usual nutrition stuff, but starting to understand this power of how you put pieces together to have synergy. How, once again, this concept of not just trying to eat the perfect diet and being miserable, but to realize that joy comes from being around people who make you feel better about yourself, finding support, finding a good dieter, finding a good doctor, a coach, a dietitian, whoever it is. But you want to find people that when you see them, they don't say how badly you suck and I can't believe you did that. You're a bad person because you did X. No, I understand you fell down. That's okay. We all fall down. And the most important thing is, I'm so proud of you, and you should be so proud of yourself because you stood back up and you had the courage to come to me and have this honest conversation where you're vulnerable. You see, these are just little tiny things that we can do as providers, whatever setting that is. And as we get into specific numbers, I have patients where I give them salt tablets. I give them urea tablets because they are hyponatremic. They have a physiological condition where their salt is too low. I have patients whose blood pressures are so low that I physically have to give them medicines or tell them, hey, I need you to eat more salt. And then there's others where when we reduce the salt, next thing you know, they start to get better. And then when we talk about salt issues, what's fascinating is I hear a lot of people say, well, you need more salt. Well, no, it's actually the volume status in your body that determines everything. So hyponatremia is not that you have low salt. Hyponatremia is that the percentage of salt to the amount of water you have is lower, and that's usually because the water in your body is too much. So one of the treatments we give for hyponatremia, we give you a diuretic to get rid of extra water. So this is why this whole thing becomes so complicated. And to Robbie's point, our ability, what makes us better human beings, is our ability to take a patient, relate to them as a human being, and figure out what their needs are at that moment. That is what makes coaching great, any kind of programs great, any kind of doctor-patient relationship great, is the ability for us to individualize. When people just listen to broad recommendations and they go try to follow, they get discouraged. And you know what the crazy part of this is every time you feel like you failed, every time you say, I can't believe I screwed up, I can't believe I gave up my diet, your brain doesn't know the difference between when you're joking or when you're being serious. Every negative thing you say in your mind and out loud, it processes it as real and it responds by saying, you know what, maybe I am not worth it. Maybe I'm not that good. And that's why, you know, the thing that I love about Cyrus and Robbie is they have this magical way of taking people and uplifting them, bringing them out and realizing that they're worth something. And that concept allows them then to be able to help them to say, look, I'm not going to act like I'm a know-it-all. I'm going to ask you to stand with me, next to me, and be able to see what I see. And that's why I think the secret here is What's the common ground? We're all going to agree on some basic things. Sleep more, move more, love more, and eat more whole foods. Eat them. They come out of the ground, put them in your mouth. It sounds great. It works really, really well. Leave the mud behind. That's it. That's literally it. And you're on your way. Then the other piece of all of the details, I can tell you they'll come later, but we will work together to figure out exactly what you need and have that patient, doctor, patient, dietitian, patient, you know, coach relationship to fix that for you.
Thank you. I asked Brenda Davis once about blood sugar, and she gave an answer that was very interesting, that kind of obvious, but hasn't been said. I said, if you eat beans like chickpeas, lima beans, lentils, you know, white beans, and grains like quinoa, millet, amaranth, teff, buckwheat, wild rice, and sweet potatoes and squash, could it raise your blood sugar? And her response is that you shouldn't overeat, that overeating anything could raise your blood sugar. So many of my questions are about what to eat, what to eat, what to eat. And she kind of, in a very logical way, saying that, like, no matter how healthy you're eating, overeating itself is a cause of raising your blood sugar. What's your experience with that?
She basically said, so overeating
anything. She's saying that, yeah, overeating anything. Like, I was kind of making it like, if you eat whole food plant-based, are you good? And she was kind of saying, like, you know, overeating anything affects your blood sugar. So to sit there and pile on unlimited beans with wild rice and squash and sweet potatoes can raise your blood sugar, you know, at least, yeah.
So I think, yeah, so my original mentor, Doug Graham, he has a great quote. He says that all things that are healthful are healthful in moderation, and a poison is a poison regardless of the dose. And I think that's an interesting, there probably could be some nuanced exceptions there, but in general, the point stands, like, things that are healthy for us are healthy in moderation, you know? And so, and then the things that are unhealthy, we should just try and limit or avoid completely. So I guess, yeah, you could eat too much of anything. If you have, again, this is where, you know, what Dr. Sean is saying with his whole original take here, which is so profound, but like, everything has to be personalized. Somebody could, maybe they have an eating disorder past, and there's a reason for that, and that they need the support and the acknowledgement. We had to work through that. Can you overeat on potatoes? Can you overeat on mangoes? I mean, it's harder than processed food, but it's definitely possible. And that stuff has to be worked through. So I think Brenda's point is valid.
So when you look at patients suffering from the disease of obesity, because it is a disease, it's not a matter of willpower. But what happens is, to Brenda Davis, and Brenda is a friend and just profound person and a trailblazer. When you look at patients who are obese, when they start to eat, they don't get the same signals that go to their brain. You know, when you talk about drugs like Ozempic, and I was telling this to Robbie and Cyrus earlier, the way Ozempic works is it delays gastric or stomach emptying. So the concept there is food stays in your stomach longer. Well, what is nature's Ozempic? It's very simple. It's fiber. Fiber does the same thing. So when you eat these foods, what happens is the fiber helps you to feel that satiety. And as a result of it, you're not constantly just gobbling down. But when patients are suffering from obesity, those signal pathways don't work the same way. They actually can't stop eating. So in other words, the answer to your question is yes, it does happen. But for most people, what they have to remember is if they start to eat foods that are full. And so in our clinic for obesity management, what we tell people is eat the fruit, don't drink the juice, right? If you're going to want to make smoothies, I don't have anything against smoothies. I make smoothies too. But I tell my patients, try not to make the smoothie if you can avoid it, because I want your beautiful digestive system to act as the blender. Because when it acts as the blender, it has to take its time to separate the fiber, to do all of that stuff. When you do the work for it, it goes right through. And as a result of it, you may not get the same satisfaction. And so this is where when Robbie and Cyrus talk about how they're talking about this concept of eating whole foods, the reason that it matters is you have the greatest Vitamix inside your body. Why not let it do its magic? And if you let it do its magic, you're going to find that the satiety signals will actually occur. And if you don't let it do its magic, you help it out, then yes, it's much easier to overdo this stuff. That's the bigger point that you want to understand is your brain is like a thermostat in your house. In patients who suffer from obesity, that thermostat is dysregulated. It says it's got to be at 90 degrees, but your body says I'm happy at 74 degrees, but it keeps trying to pull you to 90 degrees. It keeps trying to tell you to eat more. That's why when you start to look at all sorts of crazy treatments, you probably remember the balloons, the gastric balloons. What do? They're literally putting balloons in your belly so that you feel your stomach full. So you get that signal going to your brain with one small thing when it blocks the outlet. Now you got an obstruction. So as you think about this concept, you see nature already thought about this. What you and I are just kind of, oh my God, that makes a lot of sense, but you can overeat anything. But nature thought about that. Nature knew if you put on a bunch of weight, you're not going to outrun the saber-toothed tiger. As a result of it, you're not going to reproduce. You're going to die. Everything from an evolutionary perspective was for the species to survive. And if you start to think about it that way, a lot of the problems that we fight over, just think about why nature did what it did. And you'll start to see a lot of sense behind it.
Thank you.
Stephen, do you mind if I draw something on the screen here?
Sure.
Okay. Can you guys see the screen? That's like a whiteboard. Let's see here. Can you see this?
It came on.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. Let me see if I can just draw this here real quick. Effectively, what we're trying to establish here, let's see if I can do this properly. Okay. I'm going to draw a graph on the screen right here. So we have basically blood glucose on the y-axis and time on the x-axis. All right. So if I'm just going to write the word here, time, and then over here, I'm going to write the letters BG. Okay. So effectively, you can think of on a daily basis, your blood glucose is going to be fluctuating, you know, while you're sleeping, when you wake up, when you exercise, when you eat, when you don't eat, when you're stressed and beyond. Okay, so, you know, to physiologically normal blood glucose variation, you know, over the course of a day is, you know, just sort of looks like this. There's just sort of like a natural cyclical variation of blood glucose, excuse the drawing, but it just kind of, you know, comes up and comes down, comes up and comes down. And this is a totally natural, you know, diurnal fluctuation. Okay, so the lower bound of this is usually somewhere about 70 on the lower end. And then the higher bound of this is about 145. And that's considered non-diabetic, perfectly normal fluctuation. Okay. Now, what can happen when you have a blood glucose dysregulation is your blood glucose can do some strange things. So in blue, I'm going to draw what can happen. You know, if you're living with diabetes, you know, some form of blood glucose dysregulation, your blood glucose can do something like this. And then at the time that you're going to eat a meal, like let's just say that this meal right here represents breakfast at this moment in time, what can happen is that your blood glucose can do this. It can go up relatively quickly, and then it gets to a point where it kind of peaks. And then it might take a while for this blood glucose value to come all the way back down. And that might do this. And then later when you eat some food, it might go back up again, and it might do this, something like that, okay? So this is a sort of like typical blood glucose variation that you would see in somebody living with type 2 diabetes or somebody that has a compromised insulin production. Now, if we measure the area under the curve in the red profile, what you'll see is that there's a little bit of dirt that you can put underneath this mound. There's a little bit of dirt you can put underneath here. There's a little bit more dirt you can put over here, and then there's a little bit more dirt here. If you compare that to the amount of dirt that you would put underneath this blue graph, you'd see that there's a small amount of dirt here, but all of a sudden there's a really large amount of dirt that you could put underneath this middle section of the graph. And then there's also a large amount of dirt that you could put here underneath this section of the graph, okay? So this here represents what's called the total area under the curve. And
ultimately what your blood vessels are, you know, responding to over the course of time, what your liver responds to, what your kidney responds to, what your muscles responds to is the total area under the curve on a 24-hour basis. And then that's multiplied every single day for, you know, months and years at a time. So the goal is to try and minimize this, you know, this area under the curve and keep it at a physiologically normal amount. But as it gets larger, that's when, you know, inflammatory process can really start to degrade tissue function all throughout your body. All right. So what Brenda is saying is, you know, if you were to overconsume food, like let's just say back here at breakfast time, we were to overconsume food. And before you know it now, all of a sudden it sends your blood glucose up to a very high value. Maybe this is a 200 or so. And then it takes a little while for that blood glucose to come back down to its baseline value. Okay. So she's saying that if you were to overeat food, even if it's the right type of food, even if it's starches and fruits and vegetables and legumes and whole grains, that can cause a high blood glucose variation. And she's absolutely right, because overconsumption of food can cause this problem. And you can see this repeated in some individual blood glucose, you know, on a regular basis. But that's not the only thing that can cause your blood glucose to do this, right? You can be in a stressed environment. You can be living in a very high stress environment. And before you know it, you have a reasonable meal and then boom, your blood glucose goes very high. Another thing that can happen is you can be sedentary. You can not be performing exercise on a regular basis. You can not be moving your body. You eat a relatively small amount of food and all of a sudden your blood glucose goes extremely high. Okay. You could be eating a high fat diet, like we talk about, you know, if your baseline consumption of fat is, you know, significantly elevated. And in this situation, you don't even have to have very much carbohydrate. And before you know it, all of a sudden your blood glucose goes very high. You could be eating a diet that doesn't contain very much fiber. And then before you know it, you have something that is carbohydrate rich, and then boom, your blood glucose goes up. So there's many things that can cause this problem, right? The point here is that Brenda is right in the sense that the total amount of food that you consume absolutely matters. And again, that's just one variable inside of the overall constellation of things that we as human beings are wanting to take into account at any given moment in time. It's the composition of the food that you're consuming. How much are you exercising? What is your stress level? Did you sleep properly? Or do you have a good, you know, low stress environment? Are you drinking alcohol? Do you smoke cigarettes? And the list goes on. So ultimately, what we're trying to do is kind of keep this blood glucose variation as controlled as possible. This is going to limit the damage and tissue inflammation across all tissues from head to toe. And, you know, Brenda, again, she's right in the sense that overconsumption of food can cause your blood glucose to go very high. But again, it's just one of many things that can cause this, you know, system to kind of like get a little out of control that can ultimately cause significant amounts of damage. Hopefully that's clear.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I don't know how to stop sharing. Let me see here. There we go.
Okay. I've spoken to, I took your book and I read from it to Brian Clement. And I've asked Brian Clement and Gabriel Cousins. And what they're saying is their version of how to lower blood sugar is to take raw sprouts and raw greens with lots of seeds, nuts, and avocados, and even oil. And that is their version. They're saying that if your diet is lunch and dinner, they're saying if breakfast is a juice of greens and lunch and dinner is a giant salad of raw sprouts, raw greens, with whatever amount of seeds, nuts, olives, avocados to fill you, that they've had great success in keeping blood sugar low. Do you like this approach? It's harder to do. It's less likely a person would do, but if someone was compliant, do the three of you like the approach of high greens, high sprouts with lots of seeds, nuts, avocados, olives, and maybe some oil as an approach to lower blood sugar? Is this a good lifetime strategy as opposed to what you're proposing?
Okay, so I'll start by saying that, you know, Brian Clement and Gabriel Cousins are phenomenal human beings. And let's put it this way, they're right. They're absolutely right. If somebody chose to eat a diet, which is effectively a high fat plant-based diet, as opposed to a high carbohydrate, low fat plant-based diet, the way that we suggest, they're going to get very stable blood glucose. There's no question about that. This is very well known, right? So effectively what they're trying to solve for, the variable that they're trying to control, is blood glucose variation. And they're trying to achieve the graph that I showed you on the screen. And in fact, they're trying to get an even fatter blood glucose profile over the course of 24 hours. And when you're consuming nuts, seeds, avocados, oils, higher fat foods, and the only you know, carbohydrate containing foods in your diet, or maybe some berries, a small amount of berries, and some green leafy vegetables, you will achieve exactly what they're saying, which is effectively a flatline blood glucose. Okay. But if that's your only output, then I think you might be missing the forest for the trees. Okay. There's a lot of things that we want to take into account. What we found over the course of time is that when you consume that, there's effectively a trade-off between the amount of carbohydrate energy in your diet and the amount of fat in your energy in your diet. Okay. So the two of them, we live in a mammalian system, and in a mammalian system, carbohydrates and carbohydrate metabolism and fat metabolism do not get along. I wish we could reinvent human beings in a way where all of the enzymes that are required to operate in a carbohydrate rich economy functioned well in combination with all of the enzymes and all of the proteins that function in a high fat environment. In other words, I wish that human beings could survive on a high carbohydrate and a high fat diet simultaneously. But from mammalian physiology, from many studies that we've seen across animals, as well as human beings, we know that that is not the case. Carbohydrate metabolism and fat metabolism do not like each other. So the reason why this is important is because what we advocate for is a high carbohydrate intake in a low fat environment. Okay. So the two of them have to be reciprocals of each other. High carbohydrate, low fat environment. The suppression of fat intake increases carbohydrate tolerance. I'll say that one more time. The suppression of fat intake increases carbohydrate tolerance, and that is very well described within the medical literature. Okay. The exact opposite happens as well, which is that consumption of a high fat diet suppresses carbohydrate tolerance. And as a result of that, you can absolutely operate in the exact opposite scenario where you're eating a high fat diet with a low carbohydrate intake, and your blood glucose will be stable in both regimes. Okay. High fat, low carbohydrate, flat blood glucose. The exact opposite. Low fat, high carbohydrate, flat blood glucose. The question really becomes, what's going to happen 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now? Which one of those two diets is more likely to lead to a better health outcome over the course of time? Okay. So from what I've researched and from all the research that, you know, we've done in the Mastering Diabetes program, I have come to a conclusion that eating a diet that is that contains a significant amount of carbohydrate rich foods that are fiber rich, including a significant amount of fruits and vegetable intake, fruits, starchy vegetables, legumes, and whole grains, is a more optimal strategy than a diet that contains nuts, seeds, avocados, and oils as your primary energy source. So if I had to choose between the two of those, what I would do is I would increase my intake of fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains because of the wide variety of fibers that you get from those foods, because of the wide variety of phytonutrients that you get from the vitamins, the minerals, fiber, water, antioxidants found in all of those classes of foods together, and a significant increase in total fiber content that you will get from eating those foods over the course of many years. I would prefer to eat that way because what I've seen is that, just like Dr. Sean Hashmi recommended, the amount of fiber that you consume on a daily basis matters. And the more fiber that you consume, not only does it help improve your kidney health, but it also helps reduce your risk for all-cause mortality. And it significantly reduces your risk for chronic conditions. So fiber is absolutely key. And Dr. Will Bolsowitz wrote about this in Fiber Fueled as well. So we must maximize fiber intake. And it's very hard to maximize fiber intake when you're consuming a diet that's very high fat, even if it's plant-based.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo all that and just add that, you know, when we look at the longest lived populations on the planet, there is not a single group that has focused on minimizing carbohydrate intake. Like of the macronutrient ratios, carbohydrate, protein, and fat, carbs is the highest in the societies that have, you know, these long lived, you know, great health spans, not just lifespans, low chronic disease. And also, if you think about it in an evolutionary perspective, access to large amounts of nuts and seeds is quite difficult. That's a modern luxury that we have. So I also think if you look at the research and explore insulin sensitivity, I would opt towards the path that not just makes you more insulin sensitive, but glucose tolerant, right? So the approach of having a It's basically a plant-based ketogenic diet we're talking about here. And that what that's doing is that's still eating yourself into a state of glucose intolerance. You're doing that program, you try and have two mangoes in a sitting, your blood glucose is going to go through the roof. I mean, just skyrocket. Just like Cyrus was saying, like these two metabolisms, they don't work together. So if you had to pick one, I would pick the one that makes me more insulin sensitive. And I also would encourage people to understand that, you know, particularly with pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, if you want really, really stable blood glucose, it's not going to be flat. It's not going to be like 87 all day long. But if you want really, really stable blood glucose, you can absolutely achieve that while following the Mastering Diabetes method. You don't necessarily have to trade one or the other. You can actually have the best of both worlds and a really, really rock solid blood glucose profile and insulin sensitivity. So that's what I would opt for.
Thank you. Do you have any, we had last night, Talis Barker and Alan Goldhammer talk about water-only fasting for kidney disease or prevention of kidney disease and prevention of type 2 diabetes. Is this an approach that you would, a proactive approach that you would recommend to do medically supervised water-only fasting? Is this an approach you would recommend for these things?
So unfortunately, the short answer to that is no. There isn't enough data out there to support a prolonged water-only fast. Because of the medications that most of our kidney patients are on, any sort of attempt at dehydration can actually cause worsening kidney functions. So remember, medications like ACE inhibitors, ARBs, SGLT2s, all of them are acting in a way that it can actually exacerbate any effects of dehydration you feel. Now, flip that around to looking at the different forms of fasting. You know, just because a little bit of something is good doesn't mean overdoing it is going to be great. Fasting is a very, very powerful tool. It is not a weight loss tool. Where it comes really helpful is it helps you to be able to switch your body's fuel sources more efficiently. Most people screw up fasting because what they think is when they fast, if I do a 16-hour fast and a 4-hour eating or 8-hour eating window, people feel that in that 8 hours, they can eat whatever the heck they want. What they don't realize is when you fast, your body is the most susceptible to whatever nutrients you give back to it. So if you give it processed junk, it's going to take that and store it right away. So you've undone all the benefit you did. Number two, when it comes time for improving kidney disease, what you're trying to do to help the kidney disease is reduce the pressure on it, the intraglomerular pressure. Just like we have high blood pressure in the body, we have intraglomerular hypertension, that's higher pressure inside the kidneys. That comes from hyperfiltration, which comes from high sugars. That comes from weight. It doesn't matter if it's absolute muscle or if it's absolute fat. If you weigh a lot, you're going to put a lot more pressure onto the kidneys. And of course, systemic blood pressure is going to end up doing the same thing. So when we talk about fasting with our patients, what fasting does is it helps you to build, instead of willpower, it creates sustainable habits. And so when you look at, for example, what is a very simple way you can incorporate fasting if you're not an insulin-dependent diabetic. If you're not an insulin-dependent diabetic, you're not pregnant, et cetera, all you have to do is stop eating 4 hours before you go to bed. That's literally it. Why does it matter? Because when you sleep with a full meal in your stomach, you actually don't get that deep, restful sleep. Not my opinion. Everything that I'm telling you, you can go ahead and go on PubMed and find it right now. You'll find that the people who eat late at night, right before going to bed, they end up craving high sugar foods the next day. So if you want to help with your weight loss journey, if you want to help with your kidney, if you want to help with the fact that you're a non-insulin dependent diabetic, don't eat late. So, you know, it's all that thing about there's so many arguments about whether you should have breakfast or don't have breakfast. I don't want to, you know, have tomatoes thrown at me. What I'll tell you is that if you look at your journey, if you eat breakfast, make that bigger because you have all day to be able to move and burn it off. Lunch is medium and dinner is really meant to be a smaller meal. People think dinner is family time. Of course, it's family time, but it's family time where you're enjoying their company not looking at your smartphone and eating food at the same time. So this is what I mean by that is, when it comes to fasting, remember, fasting is going to help you to switch between burning carbs, being able to utilize those fat stores more efficiently. It's a fantastic tool. When you look at what it does in terms of cognitive health, it's phenomenal. Migraines, it works really, really well. When you start to look at seizure, there's data around seizures where fasting can make a difference. But the reason we get concerned in kidney patients with prolonged water fast is because the worrisome part there is you have a lot more likelihood of getting into trouble, especially if you end up dropping your blood pressure a little fast. And you really can in people who've been eating badly and now do fast. That's why when we do fasting, we start very slowly. Even if you look at Walter Longo's fast mimicking diet, it's not a prolonged water fast. Fast mimicking diet is every few months, 3 to 4 months, it's 4 to 5 days of controlled. He's going down to about 800 calories a day of meals for about 5 days. Those 800 calories cover all of your essential macros. They also cover all of your essential micronutrients. It's a very controlled way of doing it. So this is where I'm a nephrologist. I spent 25 years being a nephrologist. Literally all I do is look at studies. And I always tell people I'm not the expert. I always worry about anybody who claims they're the expert.
Thank you. Okay. So if each of you could make a final closing statement summarizing any final thoughts that you want to share and leave with us, and then also what is the best way to follow up with your work? Do you do consultations? Do you have books, websites, programs, anything for us to follow up with? Dr. Hashmi, do you want to start? Then Robbie, then Cyrus?
I put my YouTube channel on there. So, you know, the only thing I'll say is there's way too much diet advice in the world. You don't need more diet advice. What you need is the greatest secret to living longer is to truly become a self-centered person. And what I mean by that is the more selfish you become, the longer you're going to live. And so what that statement says is every single time you express gratitude, every single time you go do something kind for somebody, it actually reduces your stress hormones, it improves insulin sensitivity, and it guarantees that you're going to improve your health span and lifespan. So yeah, you want to be selfish, it's all about you, you want to live longer, you want to live better, all that stuff, that's great. Go do something kind and be kind. You don't have to be the expert. It takes a lot more courage to express gratitude and kindness than it is to say, I'm right and you're wrong.
And if someone wants to follow up with your work, how would they, do you do consultations over the Zoom or are you
No, I don't do consultations, but we have a monthly live Q&A where people come on and ask questions and all the links are on the YouTube channel.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. People can connect with us over at Mastering Diabetes. If you click on recipes in the top there, that would be great. So if you're looking for some amazing recipes and just want to kind of dabble in eating more plants, definitely check this out. There's a lot of really good stuff here. And if you're interested in, you know, getting personalized coaching, you can just click any of the buttons and you can book a call to talk to our enrollment specialists and see if you're a great fit for the program and get aligned with our amazing coaching team.
Great. Thank you very much, Robbie. Cyrus.
Stephen, thank you so much again for putting this whole thing together. It's been a pleasure to be here. What I'll say to sort of like close everything here is that over the course of the last 10 years, as I've been involved in the world of, you know, diet and fitness, I've come to learn and observe that with every passing day, week, month, year, it just gets more confusing. There's more voices in the world of social media today than there's ever been. There's more so-called experts that you know, have a solution for your health. And you as the individual just trying to find a solution for your health today and into the future
can easily get confused saying, I think that person knows. I think that person knows. How come they don't agree with this? How come I heard this over here? And how come they said the exact opposite over here? Why are these two people debating each other? And now I'm ultimately confused. And, you know, what I ultimately get frustrated by is that, you know, there's so much conflict in the world. And especially when it comes to nutrition advice, it's like, there's just too much conflict, and it creates apathy, right? And the apathy can ultimately result in, you know, people who really want to find a solution eventually get to a point where they're like, you know what? Even these so-called experts can't even agree. What the hell? I'm just going to do nothing. I'm just going to continue with what I'm doing right now. I'm just going to continue to take these medications that my doctor's giving me. There doesn't seem to be an answer, right? And ultimately, I think if you as an individual get to that point and you don't really know what to do and you kind of get apathetic about the lifestyle change process, that's a loss, because there's so many things that research has proven over the course of time to be very effective for improving your overall health. And, you know, somehow that the truth gets lost in the fray. So what I would recommend for all of you who are, you know, you guys are here, you guys have been paying attention, you guys have been attending, you know, this conference and probably many other conferences, you guys are committed. And I love that. And I want you guys to stay focused. And I want you guys to stay really, pointed in the right direction, trying to get the best information possible. And I strongly commend you for that. And I encourage you to continue to try and gather as much information as you possibly can, but ultimately to start making changes to your lifestyle that, you know, are evidence-based. There's a lot of information that appears to be evidence-based, and there's a lot of nonsense, unfortunately. And, you know, the scientific evidence matters. It absolutely matters. So I want to say thank you to all of you guys for being here. Thank you for putting in your time and your effort. If you want to, you know, follow, you know, my work into the future, you can go to evolution-health.co. I just dropped it in the chat box. You can see that. Click on that link and you can download a freebie. We'll send it over your way. If you want a consultation, we're happy to do that for free. No questions asked. I want to be able to help in whatever way possible. So please, you know, don't hesitate to ask questions. Don't hesitate to reach out. We're here for you. And again, Stephen, thank you so much for putting this whole thing on. You are a gem of a human being. And I know you yourself are so fully committed to this process that it's truly an exceptional, it's an honor.
Great. And thank you to all three of you for doing this work, writing your books, being available. Somehow this information should be easily available, but somehow it isn't, or maybe it's harder to get. So we really appreciate all of you making yourselves available. My dad, you know, had bad diabetes. He had chronic kidney disease. He died of that. And I'm very grateful that you guys are all willing to share this. It's hard to get in touch with doctors these days. It's hard to get in touch with dietitians. It's really great that you're available to share this. So thank you. And if we could unmute everyone, so everyone also can thank you for sharing this information with them.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's really interesting hearing all three of you talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.